This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, May 7th. Last Saturday, after posting my column from Paris, one in which I blasted Barack Obama for failing to lead on two specific issues, the Middle East, North Africa, and our humongous deficits, I did what I always do when in Paris, go to the War Museum, Musée de l'Armée, which is also the site of Napoleon's tomb. I've been to war museums all over the world, and the one in Paris is as good as they come in its exhibits on World Wars I and II. As I walked through, I took the same notes I always do, and each time I look at the exhibit for World War I, I'm reminded just how quickly things exploded following the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, in Sarajevo, June 28, 1914. Gavrilo Princip was the Serbian nationalist who carried out the crime, but Serbia itself had nothing to do with it. Nonetheless, Austria-Hungary opted to exploit the assassination and teach the Serbs a lesson, and a month later Vienna declared war on Serbia. 2 days later, Russia entered. August 1st, Germany declared war on Russia. August 3rd, Germany declared war on France. August 4th, Britain declared war on Germany and was off and running. Or, rather, by the end of September, the war had ground to a halt on the main fronts, but they kept killing each other indiscriminately. France, for example, lost 1.37 million men in the war, with another 4.95 million wounded out of 8.5 million men mobilized. Think about that casualty rate. I saw a clip of the Victory Parade, July 14, 1919, in Paris, and it was pathetic. Very few marchers were in one piece. Of course, what followed was the flawed Treaty of Versailles in 1919, Hitler rose to power in 1933, Neville Chamberlain in September 1938 told his cabinet Hitler appears to be a, quote, man who could be relied upon when he had given his word. And shortly thereafter, Hitler takes over the Sudetenland, and in essence, World War II is underway, though Hitler waited about a year until his military was fully ready before formally launching the war with the invasion of Poland, September 1, 1939. In 1940, France falls. Britain retreats from Dunkirk, the greatest retreat in the history of mankind, and by June 4th, Winston Churchill is appearing before the British Parliament, girding his nation for battle. I get goosebumps every time I read his words. We will fight on our beaches, we will fight on our airfields, we will fight in the fields and in the streets, we will fight in the hills, we will never surrender. 2 weeks later, June 18, Marshal Pétain, having surrendered France to the Germans the day before, while setting up a separate government in Vichy that then collaborated with the Nazis, General Charles de Gaulle took to the BBC airwaves from London in his own initial attempt to rally the French and begin to form a resistance to the Nazis. France has lost a battle, but France has not lost the war, he said. Nothing has been lost because this war is a world war. Whatever happens, the flame of resistance must not be extinguished and will not be extinguished. So now the Battle of Britain was on, and when it was over, the Luftwaffe had lost 1,773 aircraft, and an invasion was postponed. As Churchill put it, never in all of history has so much gratitude been owed by such a large number of people to so few. As for de Gaulle, who was recognized by Britain as the leader of the Free French Movement on June 27, 1940, in 1941 he was helping liberate Lebanon and Syria. It's this last bit that is one of the reasons I bring this all up, events of almost 170 years ago. As I walked the streets of Paris last Saturday, after going to the museum, I was oblivious to what was on President Obama's mind that day, just as all but a handful of Americans back home were as well. But I was in France, as I told you before I went there, to attempt in my own small way to get a handle on the explosive immigration issue that is being fanned by the Arab Spring, as tens of thousands of refugees flood into Italy and France, and all points north and east. For years now I've written of the slow rise of nationalism in Europe, a disquieting trend, and the process is being accelerated due to events in Tunisia and Libya, for starters. If you want to be dumped in one spot in Paris to get a handle on the immigration issue, and you don't want to visit some of the awful train stations as I have over the years, go to the Eiffel Tower. where you'll see 100 or so new immigrants hawking cheap keepsakes of the place, as well as loads of rather intimidating-looking Serbs on the bridge across the Seine, playing shell games. This is not Paris' best face. Most of the rest of the city that I ventured through, I hasten to add, was as beautiful as I've ever seen it. Sunday, after Mass at Notre Dame, I tried to get into the Natural History Museum. It's then I realized that most of the museums were closed on May Day. This proved to be an amazing stroke of good luck, though, as upon return to the area of my hotel, I stumbled on the National Front's, or Front National, FN party, annual May Day assemblage, and there I was, about 50 yards from the stage, amid a crowd later described as 3,000, getting ready for FN leader Marine Le Pen's address. For me, this was a tremendous opportunity, having written a while back of the rise of Marine, daughter of FN founder Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was also on the scene. It was fascinating. While I obviously didn't understand 98% of her speech, I watched her closely on the video screen in front of me and the reaction of the crowd. She's a leader and is currently ahead of President Nicolas Sarkozy in most of the polls leading up to next year's election. The socialists are in the overall lead. Of course, the National Front is an anti-immigrant, once virulently anti-Semitic party in Jean-Marie's heyday, and I am not condoning the party platform. But Marine, a mother of three, is trying to distance herself from the more radical elements of the FN manifesto and to be more inclusive, though in her speech at the foot of a statue of Joan of Arc, no less, she railed against the Euro and French immigration policy, referring to Tunisian immigrants who showed up in Paris. I later saw an article where 130 of them were squatting in an abandoned building, deemed unsafe, refusing to leave when pressed by authorities. We are tired, we are hungry, we want papers and freedom. But as part of her kinder FN face, Marine also said, quote, whether you are a man or woman, Christian, Jewish, or Muslim, believer or non-believer, you are first and foremost French. Ironically, Marine was featured in the Sunday Times magazine last week, wherein she said that her message isn't xenophobic, but rather commonsensical, pointing repeatedly to the U.S. as a model. In France, we often say the U.S. is a multicultural society, but it's not true. It's multi-ethnic, but one single culture. I don't say that nobody should enter our country. On the contrary, in the old days, immigrants entered France and blended in. They adopted the French language and traditions, whereas now entire communities set themselves up within France, governed by their own codes and traditions. I would add, see the above Tunisia 130, hanging out in the abandoned building. Marine Le Pen's message is more complicated than just the above, and I'll be talking about her the next year. What's clear is the FN is but one far-right nationalist party across Europe that is gaining traction, others being Finland's True Finns, 19% in a recent election, Norway's Progress Party, Denmark's People's Party, the Democrats in Sweden, and other such parties in the Netherlands, Belgium, Switzerland, Italy, and Austria. It's a movement that is only going to grow, and with the increasing turmoil over the euro currency, the haves versus the have-nots, and people such as the Finns and Germans increasingly unwilling to pay for the profligacy of others, as well as the immigration problem, it could end up being explosive, particularly if Europe were to re-enter recession mode across the continent. It's why yours truly always keeps in the back of his mind historical events like the genesis of World Wars I and II. The first was to be the war to end all wars, they said at the time. How's that worked out for planet Earth since then? And you should never take your eyes off the Balkans, including Greece, these days. So the above was what was on my mind when I awoke Monday morning to word that an elite unit of America's finest had taken out bin Laden and that President Obama had led the way. I was too far away to celebrate, and there was no dancing in the streets of Paris. But Monday night for my last dinner in the city, I was going to return to a favorite spot when I walked past this Irish pub and thought it might be a good place to get a reaction or two. No doubt, Europe's elite have found things to bitch about when it comes to the operation in Abbottabad. But as I overheard an Irish lad say at the bar, the Americans didn't mess around. They seldom do. That's not a bad thing. There was certainly a feeling of supreme respect for the United States in the air. But to close the circle, no, I do not apologize for my comments on our president last time. We must press the cause of democracy in the likes of Syria and Iran, even if doing so in the former makes the Israelis a bit squeamish as I discuss in my full column. The war on terror is being eclipsed at light speed by developments transpiring in this Arab Spring. We have no idea yet how things will work out, but we do know this. Iran has been taking advantage of this period to continue with its nuclear program while attention is focused elsewhere. Plus, Egypt has critical elections this fall and has reopened the gate to Gaza, while talking of annulling its peace treaty with Israel, leaving Israel feeling increasingly encircled, far more so than before. These are scary times, and it's why you'll have to forgive me. Had I been back in the States last Sunday night, my celebration would have been a muted one. I'll continue to honor the brave men and women of our armed forces at the end of each column, just as I've done unfailingly since 9/11. By the end of the year, I'll return to Arlington National Cemetery to pay my respects to the fallen of both Iraq and Afghanistan. I just pray President Obama continues to focus not just on the war on terror, but the really big picture. It is not only a time to roll up Al-Qaeda for good, and on this he's focused, but a time to press American principles and values throughout the Middle East and North Africa. Back in 1940, it was Winston Churchill versus evil, and he emerged victorious. Today, the oppressed, including in places like Syria, need America's leadership. We have an opportunity. We must grab it. As for Pakistan, in reaction to the operation to take out bin Laden, President Asif Ali Zardari wrote in a Washington Post op-ed, "Some in the U.S. press have suggested that Pakistan lacked vitality in its pursuit of terrorism, or worse yet, that we were disingenuous and actually protected the terrorists we claimed to be pursuing. Such baseless speculation may make exciting cable news, but it doesn't reflect fact." That was Ali Zardari. "Well, the fact is, Mr. President, your security service, the ISI, has always played a slippery, duplicitous game with terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Pakistan doesn't want the United States to turn over Afghanistan to India, so it wants to promote instability in Afghanistan, and in all honesty, a return over time of the Taliban, which until 9/11 had been formal friends with the Pakistani government. When it comes to the terrorist group Lashkar-e-Taiba, responsible for the Mumbai attacks, the ISA tolerates them because LET can be used to target India at will and wreak mayhem during any possible conflict between the two nations, which seems increasingly likely these days." CIA Director Leon Panetta said it all in referring to the operation on bin Laden. "It was decided that any effort to work with the Pakistanis could jeopardize the mission." So now, Pakistani Chief of Staff General Kayani says there will be no more violations of Pakistan's sovereignty, but Pakistan desperately needs the $1.5 billion in aid it receives from Washington annually, particularly the military. "It's a tough call," as Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina, says. "For those who want to cut off aid to Pakistan, I understand your frustration, but at the end of the day, if you want to create a failed state in Pakistan, one of the best things to do is sever relations. It is not in our national security interest to let this one event destroy what is a difficult partnership, but a partnership nonetheless." This past June 8th, in this very space, in discussing an assassination I had basically called the week before, that of Governor Salman Taseer, I wrote, quote, the immediate question and ongoing concern when discussing Pakistan is, to what extent are security forces infiltrated by extremists? We know the Army and intelligence services are, but does this mean a coup is a certainty? A coup that would, yes, cause the markets to tank over fears for control of Pakistan's nuclear weapons and an almost certain war with India. Before Taseer was gunned down at a high-class shopping mall, the story for the week had been the lack of cooperation that Pakistan's Army Chief of Staff, General Kayani, was supplying the U.S. in terms of going after the Taliban's and Al-Qaeda's safe havens. Kayani was supposed to be a good friend, a man the U.S. could count on, but evidently he's upset by the WikiLeaks cables showing him as being too chummy with Washington, which doesn't go over well at home, so he needs to be the bad guy now. And so he is, and clearly has been. I also can't help but note that just last week I wrote, "Speaking of Afghanistan, our terrific friends, the Pakistanis, have been lobbying Afghan President Hamid Karzai against establishing a long-term relationship with Washington, and instead looking to Pakistan and China for help in striking a peace deal with the Taliban." So that's just a brief summary of some of the events of the past week. I have far more material at StocksNews.com, my week in review column. stocks slid on economic fears and a noted collapse in the commodities markets, which I cover in full as well in the Week in Review, with the Dow Jones losing 1.3% to 12,638 after running up nearly 4% the previous 2 weeks. The S&P 500 lost 1.7% and NASDAQ 1.6%. We've had some technical issues Saturday. Today, I apologize, and hopefully we can sort them out for next time. Have a great week. I'll be back with you Saturday, May 14th. Take care.